Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Dr. George Tiller believed a woman's body is smarter than a doctor's. He used to wear a pin on his lapel that said, "Trust women." He provided abortions for more than three decades and was one of the few doctors in the country to provide third trimester abortions. The third trimester begins at the 25th week of pregnancy, and they account for less than 1% of all abortions in the country. In 1993, an anti-abortion extremist shot Dr. Tiller in both arms. His Wichita, Kansas clinic was also bombed. And then on May 31st, 2009, Dr. Tiller was shot and killed in his Wichita, Kansas church. The new documentary, After Tiller, explores the controversial topic of third trimester abortions in the 4 years since Dr. Tiller was assassinated. And here is a clip from the film After Tiller.
There are all sorts of dangers. Postal workers, firemen, police officers. Everything has a risk to it. I would prefer, personally, to have a challenging, stimulating, emotionally and spiritually rewarding career that is short, rather than have a long one that is filled with mediocrity, feeling as if you don't make any difference to people.
Tiller has performed legal abortions since 1973. His women's health care services clinic is just one of three in the nation which perform late-term abortions after the 21st week of pregnancy.
For more than two decades, George Tiller was a target of anti-abortion extremists. His Wichita clinic was bombed in 1985. In 1993, he was shot in both arms. And then, at the age of 67, he was murdered at church.
So you caught him unaware?
I believe so.
And do you feel that you have successfully completed your mission?
He's been stopped.
On Twitter, one person wrote, "Oh, happy day, Tiller the baby killer is dead." Another wrote, "God bless the gunman." Clearly, the passions in this issue have not gone away.
This man is executing babies about to be born in late term.
Tiller's dead. We move on to the next battle. We move on to the next villain.
Now U.S. Marshals are...
And that is a clip from the new documentary After Tiller, which is in theaters now. And you can find information about where it's showing at yourcallradio.org. Today, there are only four doctors in the entire country who perform third trimester abortions. And the film shows how they risk their lives and professions every day by doing this work. The physicians are Dr. Leroy Carhart, Dr. Warren Hearn, Dr. Susan Robinson, and Dr. Shelley Sella. The film also tells the stories of the patients who are seeking late-term abortions. By understanding why women and their partners are seeking these abortions, we can begin to understand why access to this procedure is necessary. Joining us to talk about the film today is Lana Wilson. She's one of the directors of the new documentary, After Tiller, and this is her first film. Hi, Lana. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're also joined in studio by Samara Azamyu. She's Executive Director of Access Oakland. That's an organization that combines direct services, community education, and policy advocacy to promote reproductive options and access to quality health care for women here in California. Access was founded in 1993 by clinic escorts who witnessed the many barriers women were facing, especially young and poor women, to actually obtain an abortion. Hi, Samara. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Rose. So nice to be here in the studio with you.
It's great to have you. So, Lana, I can't believe this is your first film. Congratulations. I mean, it is so chilling and such a tearjerker. Many parts are actually really hard to watch because we just don't hear these stories really in the media. And first off, why did you decide to make this film? When did you first learn about Dr. Tiller?
Well, I first learned about him in 2009 when he was assassinated. I mean, I wasn't, you know, I always considered myself pro-choice before this, but I wasn't an activist. And so I didn't know who Dr. Tiller was. And the idea for the film really came from seeing that he was shot on the news. It was covered wall to wall on the cable networks, but it was always covered in the same way that the mainstream media always treats the abortion debate. You know, they would say a controversial doctor has been killed. You know, our country is at war over abortion. And then they would get a talking point from each side of the issue, making it as sensational and polemical as possible, basically. And that was about it. And watching that, I was struck by the fact, first of all, that he was killed in a church. Mm-hmm. To think that the number one target of the anti-abortion movement was also a deeply religious Christian surprised me and made me really curious about who this guy was. And then, you know, I also learned from watching the news that he'd been shot once before in the 1990s. He was shot in both arms and he went back to work the next day. And I just thought, who would do that? I mean, politics aside, who would do a job where you go to work every day fearing for your life and under such pressure, a pariah in your own community? It's not like people are treating you like a hero by any means for taking these risks. And so I just wondered, on a human level, who would do this work and why? I didn't know why women would seek third trimester abortions. And as you say, what we quickly learned, my co-director Martha Shane and I filming, was that the circumstances these women are in are unimaginable. And you're right, they're never talked about in the media or in anywhere else because this is cloaked in so much stigma and shame and secrecy, this issue. So the idea really came, you know, the goal was to make a film that looked at the gray area because this isn't black and white when you come down to it. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the real situations that these women are facing who come to these clinics, you see that the decisions they're making have very little to do with the rhetoric around abortion politically, which is often a lot of abstract questions like when does life begin and that kind of thing. But when you come down to it, these women are there because they have a deeply compromised pregnancy that was planned and wanted, because they were raped and in denial, because they're a very, very young teenager who had no idea what even the basic signs of pregnancy were because they hadn't had a comprehensive sex education. It's situations like that that you would just never think of and that are a lot messier and gray than the political debaters would have you think.
Yeah, and that's what I appreciated about the film, is that you really do bring these stories to light and give a voice to the people who are actually affected by, you know, the protesters, the laws, what have you. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like for you to travel around the country and just listen to such personal stories?
It was really a privilege that so many patients led us into their lives at what for them is, I imagine, one of the most difficult situations they'll ever go through, an incredibly emotional ordeal in a lot of ways. For all of them, for almost all of them, I would say it's the worst and most difficult thing that's ever happened to them, winding up in a situation where they're seeking a third trimester abortion. And they're desperate, they're scared, you know, it's very hard for them. And they let us in, the ones who did agree to be in the film, I think because they understood better than anyone the value that could come from telling their stories, because they had never thought they'd wound up there. And you think of their experience, they have to go into the clinic past protesters shouting at them, then they arrive at the clinic, they've had to save a huge amount of money to get there in the first place, then they have this abortion, and then they have to go home to their communities and explain what happened to their pregnancy. I mean, they've really been through it all, and they understood that hearing those personal stories is the only way that anyone can possibly understand why these doctors do this work.
And Samara, you saw the film last weekend, and at Access, you work directly with women. Some women don't have the money to get an abortion. They need a place to stay because of restrictions. Can you also talk about the power of telling these stories?
Yeah, I mean, I could just say for myself personally, I started at Access in 2007 providing overnight housing for women in California who are traveling exceptionally long distances, hundreds of miles, to get to the clinic where they could be seen.
And why do they travel hundreds of miles? People might be surprised to hear about this because we live in what's often called a pro-choice state. Governor Brown just signed a piece of legislation that allows nurses to perform abortions. It's one of the mm-hmm. only laws in the country that have passed to actually expand abortion access.
Right. So we passed AB 154 this year so that advanced practice clinicians, nurse practitioners, and nurse midwives could perform early abortion services. But before this law is implemented, where we're at in California, about half of California counties don't have an accessible abortion provider. And in California, abortion services can be available in some areas up to 24 weeks. But in circumstances beyond that, people are traveling to other states. So if somebody lives in a rural area, they might have to travel a pretty significant distance just to be seen by somebody. If they aren't able to get services in that clinic, they can have to travel to another clinic after that. And so people experience really significant delays in trying to save the money. And the later somebody gets in pregnancy, the more expensive their procedure is going to be. So sometimes it's saving money and saving money, and then it just gets more and more expensive and can kind of roll like that. So I would just say that funding is a really huge barrier for people, and at Access, providing funding for abortion is something that we do. Navigating insurance can be really tricky for people. Also, I think a big thing that I didn't think about when I started doing this work was childcare. Most of the women, I would say probably 60% of our callers already have kids, and that's pretty standard with the national average. And then finding transportation or sometimes just gas money and a place to stay when you're traveling a long way. And I think the other piece that really can't be underestimated is taking time away from other responsibilities that people have, especially if they're the sole income provider for their family. Taking time off of an hourly job can just really be an incredibly burdensome thing to put on women and families.
And because a third trimester abortions are so controversial, in the media they often call them late-term abortions, but we rarely hear that they account for less than 1% of all abortions in the country. Lana, what was your opinion of third trimester abortions before you started the film, and what is your opinion of them now?
Yeah, well, I didn't know anything about third trimester abortions. I mean, I wondered, when Dr. Tiller was killed, I wondered, wow, why would a woman wait until the third trimester of pregnancy to have an abortion? And that's a question I've gotten frequently since making the film, and I'm sure Samara has gotten often too. Mm-hmm. And what I've realized is that no woman is waiting until the third trimester of pregnancy. I mean, that's the bottom line. Either she didn't find out she was pregnant until late, or it was a planned pregnancy that was very much wanted, and the parents have found that there is a fatal, a lethal fetal anomaly in the pregnancy, or a fetal anomaly that would make this baby have a life full of pain and suffering that they do not want it to have. Or the woman has been trying to get an abortion since the beginning, and this is a little of what Samara was talking about, but it has taken her time to raise the money, to get the time off work, to get the child care, to get across the country. So that's the biggest thing I realized, that no one is just waiting, oh, should I have an abortion or not? And then in the third trimester, they decide to have an abortion. That just doesn't happen. And the other thing that I've realized, though, too, is, yeah, there are so many women who are coming from lives of total chaos in this country, lower-income women, like Samara mentioned, working multiple jobs. I mean, what they go through to get to these clinics and see these doctors is really astounding. So I think that I learned from making the film, sometimes I would meet a patient and I would think, okay, I understand why it took you 3 months to raise the money, but then why couldn't you have come in month four or month five or whatever happened? But the more you get to know these people, the more I talk to each woman, the more stuff would come out where I would just be like, okay, I have no idea how hard your life is. I mean, for people who are relatively privileged like me, I've always had access to contraception, for instance, and I had sex education in high school, so I knew the basics. But the fact is that so many women in this country don't even have that. And realizing that, I think, just made me a lot more compassionate and a lot less judgmental towards not just the patients I met, but just towards people in general, because it makes you realize you never have any idea what someone else has been through and where they're coming from.
Well, let's hear another clip from the film After Tiller. In this clip, you're going to hear the voice of Dr. Shelley Sella, who performs third trimester abortions. She's from Albuquerque, New Mexico, but she does travel like many of the other doctors to other states because, again, there are only four doctors who perform these procedures in the country. And in this clip, she is with patients who are pregnant with very sick babies, and they talk about the decision to have a third trimester abortion.
I think about what I do all the time, and I recognize what I do. And at times I struggle and at times I don't. But I always come back to the woman and what she's going through. And often, what life will this baby have? What will it mean to be alive with horrific fetal abnormalities? It's not just about being alive. It's about life and what does it mean?
Thank you.
Ours is a corpus callosum.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if a baby didn't get part of his brain, what outcome of that can possibly be good? And ours has been guilt, because it's guilt no matter which way you go. Guilt if you go ahead and do what we're doing, or bring him into this world and then he doesn't have any quality of life.
We had already gone shopping for the room, and we had already bought a crib, and we had already bought dressers, and we had already bought a lot of stuff. And then we talked, and we tried to figure out why this happened and what we had done wrong. Because I have an 11-year-old son already, and he's a good kid, and he's perfect. So I coach him in all the sports. And we just finished basketball, and when we met with you yesterday, when you left the room, I mean, we prayed, and I said, if I'm not supposed to be here, if we're not supposed to do this, give us a sign right now, and now we'll get up and we'll leave. I want my child to have as good a chance as anybody and have a quality of life. And I mean, most people, they never go through anything like this. They don't understand the guilt that goes along with it. You want to do the right thing, and this is not per se the right thing as some people would view it. But I think in the end, it's best for the baby not to bring them into this hard world like that.
And that is a clip from the documentary After Tiller, which is in theaters now. It explores the controversial topic of third trimester abortions, which account for less than 1% of all abortions in the country. It also looks at Dr. George Tiller, who believed a woman's body is smarter than a doctor's. He was shot and killed in his Wichita, Kansas church on May 31st, 2009. And now there are only 4 doctors in the country that provide third trimester abortions. And we're speaking today about After Tiller with one of the directors, Lana Wilson. This is her first film. We're also joined by Samara Azamu. She's executive director of Access Oakland. They provide services, education, and policy advocacy to promote reproductive options for women living in California, especially women of color and poor women. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on what we're currently facing right now as, over 400 laws have passed in the last year to restrict abortions at a time when, according to a Wall Street Journal NBC News poll, 7 in 10 Americans believe Roe v. Wade should remain law. So how are you making sense of what we're facing right now? These laws just continue to pass across this country. And what's really amazing about this film is it gives these doctors a voice, and they talk about the fact that they receive death threats on a regular basis. So if you work in this field, if you had to access an abortion or any kind of reproductive care, what was your experience like? A lot of people don't know that half of the state of California, counties in the state, do not have access to an abortion provider. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And if you've seen the film, what do you think about the power of telling these stories that we don't hear in the media? You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Lana, how are you making sense of what we're facing with, you know, so many state legislators are so obsessed with abortion, and they're actually passing laws? And what I find really fascinating is that when you take these measures to the voters, they fail almost 90% of the time, right? So since 2005, 10 out of 11 propositions that would have restricted abortion in very conservative states actually lost. But when the lawmakers introduce the bills, that's when they pass.
Right. Right. Yeah, well, it is confusing. And I have to say, I'm not a policy expert. But what I take away from it is that I mean, the number one comment we get after we show the film to people is they come up and say, I had no idea how personal this is. I had no idea how complicated this is. Mm. And I feel like we see that reflected in the political debate sometimes. People, a lot of these lawmakers, I think, you know, one in three women has had an abortion, but they don't talk about it because it's so stigmatized. And I think a lot of these lawmakers are just very detached from that reality and don't really understand that this does affect people in their own lives, their mothers, their wives, their sisters, their daughters, you know. And it's been interesting. We've toured the movie a little bit in different countries. We've been to Kosovo. We've been to the UK. We're about to show it in Norway. Wow. And the number one thing I get there from people in audiences is they come up and they say, so in America, this is, politicians debate this?
Wow.
They're just completely confused because in those countries, people disagree about abortion. Sure, people disagree and they discuss it, they debate it. You know, they all have different limits in different countries. So it's certainly something that people talk about and disagree on, but it's not any part of the political debate. Mm. And that's what's so unusual. I mean, and the other unusual thing here is the level of vitriol that's been directed at abortion providers in America. That hasn't happened anywhere else.
What was it like for you to spend so much time with these doctors? Because I know some of them steer clear of the media for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a real honor. I mean, yes, two male doctors had done some press before, so they were more comfortable with being public figures. The two female doctors, including Dr. Stella, who you just played the clip of counseling a couple of patients, they had never done any press, like Dr. Tiller. Dr. Tiller's policy was not to do any press. He always said no. He said, it's not about me, it's about the patient. And you can certainly understand that in theory, but then in practice, we have several anti-abortion extremists who spend all their time trying to vilify these doctors. And there have been all of these assassinations and violence against providers. So the problem is that if you don't tell your story, if you don't explain why you're doing this work, if we don't have a forum for patients to tell their stories, then how could anyone understand it? There is no way. So we're so grateful that the women decided after about a year to participate in the film. And we really, Martha, my co-director, and I learned a lot from them about being filmmakers, because first of all, the way that they listen to people, they just listen so deeply with such focus and empathy, no judgment at all. I mean, it's just incredible. You see a lot of it in the film, how they can listen to people in these desperate situations and only have compassion, not judge them in any way. I mean, there are a lot of women who come in there and they're used to being judged by their regular doctors. You know, this doctor saying, well, you should have been taking this and that vitamins, or you should have done this that I told you to. This is your fault. This is the only clinic they've ever been to where they're not judged by their doctors. So that's one thing. And then another thing is just how deeply they think about their work. I mean, these aren't political zealots. Dr. Carr's a registered Republican. You know, they came into this to be doctors, and they've wound up having, in some ways, to be political figures. But what was always amazing to me is how articulate they are, how questioning, how they struggle with the moral and ethical dimensions of this work. And they understand that gray area on a more profound level than anyone. That was really incredible to me. So I was really inspired by them, how to think deeply about your work and to always have that in the back of your head instead of just trying to get through your day, you know? Mm.
Well, I know we have to let you go, Lana, but thank you so much for joining us and good luck.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good luck as the film continues to be released. I'd love to have you back because I think what you said about the reaction you're getting overseas is just fascinating. And that's another,
yes.
It's another angle we don't really hear about, that this is very unique in the many parts of the world.
Right.
That
right.
People just are not dealing with what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That is Lana Wilson. She's one of the directors of the new documentary After Tiller. This is her first film. It's playing now in Northern California, and you can find more information about the film at yourcallradio.org. And we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. Your Call is a program that depends on engaged listeners, and we're inviting you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can post your question or comment at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find links related to today's program.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we'll be discussing media coverage of the Affordable Care Act. As soon as the government shutdown ended, the media turned back to the Affordable Care Act. So we'll talk about how they're shaping the public's perception of the bill, and then also talk about coverage of the website glitches. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the new documentary, After Tiller. It explores the controversial topic of third trimester abortions. These begin during the 25th week of pregnancy, and they account for less than 1% of all abortions in the country. The film also tells the story of Dr. Tiller, who used to wear a pin on his lapel that said, "Trust Women." He provided abortions for more than three decades, was one of the few doctors in the country to provide third trimester abortions. On May 31st, 2009, he was shot and killed in his Wichita, Kansas church. And today we're speaking with Samara Azamyu. She's executive director of Access Oakland. They're an organization that provides services, education, and policy advocacy to promote reproductive options and access to quality health care for women in California, especially young and poor women. And now I would like to welcome Julie Burkhart to the show. Julie is founder and executive director of the Southwind Women's Center in Wichita, Kansas. It opened in April this year in the same building Dr. George Tiller's clinic had been in when he was shot in 2009. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on this morning.
Well, it's great to have you. I followed all of you after Dr. Tiller was assassinated in 2009. And I just wonder, you know, what has this journey been like for all of you, having to deal with media coverage and then trying to decide whether or not to reopen the clinic?
Well, it's been incredibly tumultuous and maniacal at times. Fortunately, we've had, you know, some really good things come out of those turbulent times, one with the reopening of this clinic, which I'm sitting in today, which is wonderful. But just, you know, I got to say, when we began to explore whether or not we were going to open a facility here in Wichita, and we did not necessarily think, honestly, that it would be in Dr. Tiller's old building. We weren't sure about that. We did a lot of talking. It probably took a good year or more in talking with people in the community about reestablishing women's reproductive health care, specifically abortion care, because people needed time to begin to heal. They needed time to just begin to wrap their heads around, you know, what would this mean for the women here, and would this be inviting violence back into this community that's been so torn apart over the last few decades?
Can you elaborate on that? I mean, what has the response been from the community?
Well, I must say, by and large, it has been positive. We definitely have had our challenges here. We have had myself and other staff members here. We've had people from the community just in random places come up to us and say, "We are so glad that you're here. We're so glad that you are reopening or you have reopened." People really extending their support for us. On the other side, we've lost vendors. We've had trouble finding a print shop, for example. I never would have expected to have trouble in that area, but we did. We've had people in this community refuse to work with us, but I must say, out of that, the relationships that we have built with people who are willing to work with us are even stronger, and those folks are even more committed to what we're doing and what we're about.
What do you think we need to know, you know, here in Northern California about what the climate is like in a place like Wichita, Kansas, in the wake of Dr. Tiller's assassination?
Well, I guess, you know, one is that even though we are in the middle of the country, and even though we have more restrictive and punitive laws. Kansas is a predatory state. Women here still need and deserve good health care. So I think that it's important to really keep that in mind, that no matter where we are in the United States, women need and deserve good quality health care, period, no matter what the political climate's like. And that I don't think that wherever we are in the United States, none of us are immune to what has happened here or has happened in other parts of the country. You know, I know that in your state, that there are places where women don't have access and where it's not so hospitable for women to go for abortion care and other reproductive health care. So I guess the short of it is that we're really in this together.
And that is Julie Burkhart. She's founder and executive director of the Southwind Women's Center in Wichita, Kansas. It opened this April in the same building Dr. George Tiller, where his clinic had been when he was shot in 2009. We're also joined by Samara Azamu, executive director of Access Oakland, which helps women in California get access to abortion. And now I would like to welcome Tammy Kromenacher to the show. Tammy is director of the Red River Women's Clinic in Fargo, North Dakota. Hi, Tammy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you. So Lana Wilson, director of the documentary After Tiller, was with us for the first half of the show, and we were just talking about the power of telling the stories of the women, because in the abortion debate in this country, it's mostly white men who dominate the conversation. And, you know, you rarely hear about the stories. Can you talk about that, just the power of talking about the women who are actually, and the men really, who are affected by these laws?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, whenever I've gone to the legislature when they are attempting, well, not attempting, they're successful in passing awful laws here. But it's one thing that I think is very powerful and does actually open some eyes. People have these preconceived ideas of who our patients are, what their situations are. Everybody thinks it's, you know, the young minor who's coming to our clinic with a predatory older male who's taking advantage of her, and we are in collusion with them. And in fact, less than 5% of our patients are under the age of 18. In this last year, I have noticed the trend that probably 20% of our patients are over the age of 35. Hmm. And I think that that would really open a lot of people's eyes. But when you talk to people about that and break down some of those stereotypes, people are more willing to listen and more willing to hear. Those everyday stories are just so powerful. I'm sitting today actually writing down some stories for a fundraiser we'll have in January using the women's voices, because when you, when the doctors talk, when Julie or I talk, that's one thing. But if you can hear that woman's voice and you can hear her story and hear her, the thought that she put into her decision, how she got to her decision, how she physically got to the clinic in places like North Dakota, it really does kind of change the dynamic. And people who may, I don't think we're going to change some of these hardcore people's minds, but people in the middle might say, oh, that's not who I thought. I can actually imagine that person. That might be my neighbor. That might be my sister. That might be my daughter.
Women over 35, what explains the increase?
You know, I think that one of the things that we're seeing in the last several years is just the trend of many more women waiting to and delaying their first child. And so these are women who've, you know, delayed their first child, you know, put career first. I just think it's the, you know, kind of natural trend that we're seeing in women's lives, and that so here they are older, and they've had a few kids and, you know, are just done. You know, maybe they have toddlers at home and can't. They have the same reasons as young women. I'm not ready right now. I have all the children I want. My family is complete as it is. She just happens to be, you know, that much later. And I do hear a lot of women saying, I didn't even think I could still get pregnant at this point. You know, those kinds of stories too are happening. But I think it's just that delay of first child.
And that is Tammy Krummenacher, director of the Red River Women's Clinic in Fargo, North Dakota. Julie Burkhart is founder and executive director of the Southwind Women's Center in Wichita, Kansas. And Samara Azamu is executive director of Access Oakland. They provide direct services, community education, and policy advocacy to promote reproductive options for women in California, especially young and poor women. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you've seen the film, how were you affected by the stories? And what do you think about the power of really telling these stories, especially from women and their partners who decide to have third trimester abortions? Again, they account for less than 1% of all abortions in the country. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment on our website. And if you have a personal story to tell, we'd love to hear from you. And let's go to Mona in Berkeley. Hi, Mona. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I am one of the women who's had a late-term abortion. Mine was 25 years ago. And I'm so happy they did this film. And I thought about writing a book myself interviewing women because the public debate is ridiculous. It's true the women who have abortions late in their pregnancy have a crisis. In my case, we found out at a late sonogram. You have sonograms later in pregnancy. They used to do them quite late. And at the end of our 5th month, we had it just to see if there were any anomalies we'd like to be prepared for or anything. We did not intend to abort a baby, even with Downs or anything. We were very much wanting to have our child no matter what. Well, we found out our baby, because of amniotic band syndrome, it's called, it had basically scrambled brains, not a proper brain, no proper lungs, organs outside the body, twisted body, really, really bad. And in fact, I was crying at the doctor saying, why is our baby even alive? And he said, well, it's on life support through the umbilical cord. And the moment the umbilical cord is cut when the baby's born, it will die. Mm. We even got a second opinion. So, and it was obvious. I saw the pictures of the sonogram, and it's excruciating emotionally, of course, but I'm just telling the story. And what happened was, you know, we realized it would die, and even then we debated, could we stand to do a late-term abortion? It was the worst time of my life going through this, and we did, after crying and praying, and I'm not even religious, decided I would lose my mind waiting 2 or 3 more months for the baby to die and then be born and then die. Mm-hmm. And that's why I said, okay, my sanity, I mean, the baby's going to die anyway, and I'll do it now rather than wait. And so we did, and I have to say, the doctor, he was here in the Bay Area, he was an angel of mercy. Mm. He was not a killer. He was an angel of mercy, and he was calm and a beautiful man. He was doing a great service for people in a terrible, terrible, tragic crisis. And that's the situation for many, many, and if not most, women having these. I don't know the statistics, but maybe the filmmaker does. And so I just wanted to share that this is the sort of situation. These are the women who go for late-term abortions.
Well, Mona, I'm so sorry that happened, but thank you so much for sharing your story. And I wonder, how do these debates affect you when you've got someone like, you know, Bill O'Reilly calling Dr. Tiller a baby killer and the media really not showing the real face behind these third trimester abortions? They don't mention the fact that they account for less than 1% of all abortions in the country. When this issue hits the media, national media, how does that affect you?
Well, I'm also a very political person, and I see clearly that it's completely political. It's a right-wing conservative, anti-abortion agenda, taking 1% of these abortions, these late-term abortions, and turning it into a big, you know, rallying point. And it's totally based on misinformation and lack of information. And it's true, people don't even talk about it, and they don't talk about what a late-term abortion is, how mine was not done by the, you know, extracting the live baby, blah, blah, blah. You know, it was a very humane method of injecting a drug that instantly stopped the baby's heart the day before, and within seconds. It was not mashing the baby kind of, you know, all those things you hear. So there's a lot of politicism around it. I mean, it's, you know, it, of course, it pees me off, as you say. But it's, I believe in action and trying to be an activist around things that upset me in the political arena. So So, yeah, the whole thing was excruciating. I went through a lot of grief, and it's okay now. It's a part of my history, like we have lots of losses in our lives. But I thought about writing a book myself, and I want to say I didn't because I was raising a small child. I had a daughter after that, and I didn't want to risk my life getting shot over writing a book on this topic while raising my child. She's now grown. I guess I could do a lot more and be a lot more vocal about it.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Mona. And Samara, at Access, you help women who need these services, but you also wanted to give out an 800 number in case women listening now might need some counseling.
Yeah, so sometimes this subject can be really intense just to listen to other people's stories, and it can bring up things that are going on within people or bring up experiences people that have had. So I wanted to make a plug for one of our allied organizations, Backline. They're a national hotline that people can call for support before, during, after experiences with pregnancy, parenting, abortion, or adoption. And they're really a wonderful service for judgment-free support. So you can find them online at yourbackline.org. And you can also call them at 1-800 or 1-888-493-0092.
Okay, thank you. And we'll put a link to that on the website. Again, 888-493-0092. And thank you again, Mona, so much for calling in. Let's go next to Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hey, good morning. I'm curious if you said 1% are late-term abortions, but as someone who worked as an abortion services vendor for many years next to an abortion clinic, one that was firebombed twice, and one of our customers was Dr. Bernard Slepian, who was assassinated in 1998 in Buffalo, New York, by an extremist type. I'm curious that abortion is not an easy procedure to go through. It tends to make women sick, mostly from the anesthetic. They leave feeling very unhappy or very ill. So it's not a minor procedure people go into. It's portrayed by certain political parties as being a lark or being uncaring about the unborn, etc. But I'm thinking that the reason that women get to late trimester abortions is because there are so many roadblocks put in their way before that. It's not a healthful medical procedure for a woman. There is surgical complication and risk. So it behooves a woman's health to get this taken care of before that. Can you comment on the roadblocks to women to get to a clinic or to do family planning? I'm reminded of a friend in Planned Parenthood who brought up at a meeting that when a young teenager comes in with a newborn baby for postnatal care, that she's given a lot of attention by staff, but yet when a teenager comes in for her monthly contraceptive check for an implant like Norplant, etc., she gets no attention sitting in the corner. So the message sent is babies get you attention. And, you know, there's a lot of currents and eddies in this. And what bothers me the most is the restrictions on the morning after pill and all that other care that goes up to it. Sorry.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, you bring up some really good points. Thank you for calling, Ken. I mean, even in here we are fighting for birth control in the year 2013 in the United States. Samara, can you talk about some of the restrictions that women face?
Yeah. First, I just wanted to address a little bit about what the caller was saying. It seemed like leaning a little bit into the safety of abortion. And just to emphasize that abortion is a really, really heavily researched and studied topic because it has become controversial. And that early abortion is very, very safe. And later abortion is still safer than delivering a baby. So when we talk about these procedures and the symptoms that people might be dealing with, and obviously it's a medical procedure, so it's not going to be super comfortable for people, and it's really important for people to have support around the procedure. And that's a little bit about what Access does as well, making sure that somebody has a support person to go with them if they need one. But the roadblocks are a really serious thing, even here in California. And I think one of the things that people in the reproductive justice movement are really drawn to in this work is addressing the root causes of those barriers to care, and really seeing that as an integral part of this work. We have to address economic justice. We have to be looking at education, jobs, childcare, and really, really addressing the root causes of poverty for the issues that affect a lot of our callers. And I just want to say that they're really incredible, strong, resilient people that we talk to every day on the phones. They're making it happen for themselves. Sometimes they just need a little support. Mm.
Julie, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, I would say that, you know, here in the county that we are in, we have at least 20,000 people who need subsidized family planning care. Mm. There are clinics like ours that also offer subsidized care, however, we're not filling that entire need. Also, teenagers have a tendency to wait until later to tell a parent, guardian, or to confide in someone that they're pregnant or think that they might be pregnant. So, you know, that is for teenagers then good to be able to give them good resources and tools and knowledge so that they're able to better identify and then move forward with being able to confide in someone where they think they are in pregnancy. And then also just lack of access. If women don't know where to go, if it's so stigmatized, then they might not be able to bring themselves to go to a clinic that they might be aware of. So those are things that I think really come into play in this region.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Ken. And next, let's hear from Sarp Axel. He's an MD candidate at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and president of Medical Students for Choice, an organization that, quote, stands up in the face of violent opposition. They work to destigmatize abortion provisions among medical students and to persuade medical schools to include abortion as part of the reproductive health services curriculum. Hi, Sarp. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. So we don't have much time, but I'd love to find out, what is the state of including abortion as part of a reproductive health services curriculum for people who want to provide abortions?
So actually, currently right now in medical schools across the United States and actually across the world, there's not a lot of focus on including abortion in the discussion of reproductive health care. I think it's really tough to identify opportunities for students in the regular curricula that schools offer. But you know, Medical Students for Choice is working to bring in additional supplemental educational programming to campuses. We have chapters in over 150 medical schools in 15 different countries across the world, and we're actively working with our grassroots organizers to enact some long-term sustainable changes in the curriculum. But again, those are long-term goals and long-term efforts that we're constantly having to fight different forces on, including, you know, administrations that really just don't want to touch the topic.
I'd love to have a panel of students on another show for an entire hour, because I do wonder, mm-hmm. how are students affected when something like an assassination happens, like when Dr. George Tiller was assassinated in 2009?
I mean, I think it brings a lot of issues to the surface which we're not typically confronted with. That we don't have much experience dealing with. The fact that a safe legal procedure could lead to such an act of violence is not something that we're taught in schools. Mm. You know, we're taught to put the patient first, whatever the patient needs, you know, that's where our focus is. And it really does shake up a lot of campuses and a lot of students when we're confronted with such an act.
Well, we've got another caller who wants to tell her story, so let's hear from Michaela in Santa Cruz. Hi, Michaela. We're almost out of time, but thanks for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to share my story. I was actually an IVF patient. I had been trying to get pregnant for a number of years. I was successful. I carried that baby through 32 weeks. And then at that point, they realized that half of the baby's brain hadn't developed. I was at UCF Medical Center. They had advised me to terminate the pregnancy. Because I was so far along in the pregnancy, I actually had to fly down to Los Angeles because I couldn't find a doctor here locally who would and actually go through terrible experience of an abortion in an abortion clinic. And here I was, somebody who had gone through IVF and wanted this baby more than anything, and then had to deal with the stigma of going to an abortion clinic to terminate the pregnancy.
Wow, I'm sorry that happened, but thank you so much for calling in. Samara?
So I know that the show's almost over, but I just wanted to kind of make a plug for two things that are happening. Going back to After Tiller, at the panel last Saturday at the Elmwood, Dr. Shelley Sella talked about the attack that's happening on her clinic right now. So I wanted to share the Respect ABQ Women that's going on right now. Again, the Respect ABQ Women.
And that's in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
In Albuquerque, New Mexico. So there's an effort right now. Somebody has put a state ballot proposition to ban abortion after 20 weeks just in Albuquerque. So it's unprecedented to have a ballot proposition that's just to ban something in one city and a state. So they really need a lot of support in New Mexico to keep her clinic open. And we definitely have callers who call us that need to go to her clinic. And so it's if you can, I would try and support that. But also I wanted to make a plug that funding is a really important piece of this. And if you're interested, there are bowl-a-thons that happen in the spring. And if anybody's interested in joining an abortion bowl-a-thon, they happen in almost every state.
Samara Azamu is Executive Director of Access Oakland. Julie Burkhart is Founder and Executive Director of the Southwind Women's Center in Wichita, Kansas. Tammy Krummenacher is Director of the Red River Women's Clinic in Fargo, North Dakota. And Sarp Axel is President of Medical Students for Choice. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss media coverage of the Affordable Care Act. As soon as the government shutdown ended, the media's attention turned back to the rollout of the healthcare law and the website glitches. How are the media shaping the public's perception about healthcare and the law? We'll be joined by the Columbia Journalism Review's Trudy Lieberman and ProPublica's Charles Ornstein. Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.